also some level of participation, and, if there's time in the end, I may talk about some other work in progress with Bobby Taylor and others. So, okay, so the basic question that started the investigation and the talk about is what it was motivated by these questions of compactifying string theory and trying to get some overall picture of the set of compactification. Is it finite or infinite? And so one example from the original heterotic string on a Colombiel, and one of the first questions of this type that I started to study is, let me briefly review this. We have the heterotic string. We choose a Colombiel threefold F, and then in what are usually called a 0-2 models, we have to choose a bundle, a homomorphic vector bundle V on F. So by choosing the Colombiel, and we've implicitly solved Einstein's equations by choosing a holomorphic mu stable vector bundle. I'll review shortly what that means. We are implicitly solving the Yang-Mills equation, and that version of this consistent with supersymmetry, the Hermitian Yang-Mills equation, which say that the holomorphic part of the curvature tensor is zero, and the 1-1 part of the field strength curvature in Yang-Mills sense is, well, zero in the heterotic strength, but I'm going to say is proportional to the Taylor form to get the more general, the most general form of these equations. So we've solved the equations of motion, and furthermore, we have to solve a tadpole cancellation condition that comes out of the discussion that led to the Green-Schwarz anomaly cancellation. So we had a modified Bianchi identity, which tells us that the second Schoenflex, so this has to be a topologically trivial counter to be D or something. So the second Schoenflex of the vector bundle, the class of trace S squared in homology, has to equal the second Schoenflex of this tangent bundle. Okay, so now the question is, what are the topological classification of the possibilities? Okay, so we want to get some sort of guide. So the ring of V has to be 3, 4, or 5. So if V is rank 3, then it will have structure for SU3, and the condition will be E6, a guide group, and so forth. You can have 4 or 5. C1 of V is 0. That's implicit in saying that it's a SU-F bundle. I just told you what C2 is. Okay, so the topological classification of a bundle is given by the list of Schoenflexes. So C2K of a bundle are the terms of the expansion of the form determinant F minus lambda. So some series in lambda that produces trace F, trace F squared, trace F cubed, and then stops at the dimension of the manifold. Okay, so for ordinary topological bundles, we could specify the type of the bundle by giving the ring, the C1, the C2, and then one more number to C3. Okay, the interval of trace F cubed, because there's only one sixth form on a real six dimensional manifold, that's just a number. And as many of you will know, the this number has a direct physical consequence. It's twice the number of the net number of generations in the resulting guide. So number of 27 minus 27 bars if you're talking about P6 and so forth. Okay, so for ordinary topological bundles exist with any value of these invariants. And so already in this first example of string compatibilization, one finds that there's this potentially infinite list of possible string compatibilizations that seem to all differ, but having different numbers of generations, not to mention possibly dwarf differences. And then you might say, well, you know, we know that the rule has three generations. Why do we care? Well, of course, this is just symptomatic. If it already in the very first, you know, consideration of the problem, you found some infinite list, then it's very likely that you'll continue and you'll put all the conditions of the standard model and you'll just keep finding infinite lists at every stage. And to the extent that there's really infinite lists of string compatibilizations that agree with the standard model and go on to predict other things, you start to worry about whether the string theory will ever predict anything. Okay, so now what is the resolution? Well, this is just a topological statement, and it exists on these holomorphic new stable bundles, which again I'll define more precisely momentarily. Then it turns out that there is a finite set of these C3. Okay, so this implies that given rank RK, C1, C2, there's just a finite set of allowed C3. And so this is a mathematical theorem first due to Mariano. And it's a good thing because immediately solves this particular possible, you know, problem of the possible infinity of models. And if you think about it, it's really not terribly obvious where this comes from. Of course, you know, if you haven't thought about these bundles and things, it's not going to be terribly obvious at all. But it's definitely not some sort of simple consequence of supersymmetry or some other argument. If you like to think in terms of brain construction, this is the direction we're going to be going shortly, then of course one could analyze a very similar, and for these, you know, SUN groups, really the same problem by wrapping V6 brains, at rank in the bundle, V6 brains on a Calabi-Yau in 2A theory. Okay, well, why, you know, what does that problem have to do with this problem? It's obviously not string compatibilization, but any good one supersymmetry. But of course, in the study of B brains, one, you know, quickly realizes that on such a collection of B brains, one is allowed to postulate that the UN, I'll say N is rank, you know, like gauge field, lives in some vector bundle V, and if you want a BVS particle, then the V should really satisfy this Hermitian Yang-Mills equation. So it does form part of this general class of problems where you start with a Calabi-Yau and break that into supersymmetry. And so in that sense, the problems are fairly closely related. And as long as you neglect string corrections on both sides, then the special case of this where you just happen to choose the charges to satisfy these conditions. Okay, so again, you know, review the topological class of the bundle. So CHV is usually the more convenient way to write it. The expansion of the form trace D to D F give you the electric and magnetic charges of this BPF particle in four dimensions. So by restricting attention to some particular charge sector, you know, just because we like it, we duplicate the basic nature of this problem, the list of possible bundles and a list of possible C3s is a list of possible charges for the BPS particles in this particular 2A string compactified on the Calabi-Yau. Okay, so it's another interesting way to attack the problem. Of course, from this point of view, it's also not terribly obvious why there should be some bound on the list. In particular, one knows that the second Sherman class, what does that correspond to? That essentially corresponds to, so turning on C2K amounts in some physical sense to making a downstay with some D six minus CK corresponds to a downstay with D six minus two K brains. So C one would have been four brains. C two is a downstate with two brains. And if you thought about these things, worked on it, you know that you could find as many D two brains to a D six brain as you want. You know, do exist bundles with arbitrarily large instant time operators. So if the C two could be arbitrarily large, why not the C three? And so it's just, you know, not obvious. Okay, but there is this non-trivial mathematical theorem which I'll come back to in a bit. Okay, so now the approach that we took to try to study this question, because you know, this point of view is pretty complicated, and here are some experts, and even, you know, I'll also mention the work of Adrian Lang, another mathematician. So far as I can tell, there are only three mathematicians in the world who have any insight into this problem, who understand this theorem. But this may be unfair, but I go around and ask a lot of people. And rather what we're going to do is we're going to come over to this picture of the problem and say, well, is there any kind of a priori constraint on the possible charges of PPS particles? And the general answer is, well, you know, no, not so far as we know. If they satisfy direct quantization, then there can be a particle. But now let's consider the limit of either large D string or large N, where I'm going to stop. So this is a U of, you know, RK bundle. What I'm now going to start saying, whenever it's like N, what I mean is, in some sense, all of the charges. Okay, so N is the, you know, in some sense, the overall scale of the vector of these electric and magnetic charges. Well, then it's familiar that the mass of such a black hole is going to go as GSN. And as we take this limit, we cross over from a description of B brains, you know, BPS particles represented by, you know, B brains with some explicit microscopic structure that we can study, over to black hole solutions in 2A supergravity. Okay, so we can take the 10-dimensional 2A supergravity and compactify that on the Clavier M and derive a 4D supergravity. And now the various, let's see, the Ramon potentials, so things like C3, C1, and their duals, wrapping various cycles in the Clavier, or the Clavier itself, lead to the vector, so 10-dimensional fields of this sort, give rise to the 4-dimensional vector potentials, and grab three grains and give rise to the charged objects under those vector potentials. Well, from the point of view of the 4-dimensional supergravity, we can find black holes with a given charge Q, a given mass, and then we can put the condition that the corresponding black hole solution of supergravity should make sense. Well, you know, when you first look at this problem, you might wonder if that's a condition at all. Maybe, you know, all charges support black holes, but there's a important and famous constraint on this, which is generally referred to as the attractor condition, the attractor mechanism. This, of course, first came out of the work of Ferrara, Kalash, Stronninger, and then Greg Moore especially emphasized the use of this as a consistency condition on black holes. So I'll remind you about this. So the original motivation for looking at this attractor mechanism was to address a potential paradox, which is that, of course, Calabi-Yau compactification leads to a theory with many scalar fields. So all of the metric moduli, as well as Dolokhov and other fields, lead to scalar fields in the four-dimensional supergravity. In particular, the Kähler moduli, in this case, of too big will lead to scalars in the vector multiplets of n equals 2 supersymmetry. And then you can try to evaluate, you find a solution. You know, so given some asymptotic boundary conditions, particular values of the scalar fields at infinity, and then the charge Q, you know, you find some solution, you know, B squared, B squared is some e to the minus A, and minus dt squared, and the radial piece, A n plus dr squared, e to the A, the omega squared, and some dependence for these fields, and you extrapolate the solution down to the horizon, and then one computes an area of horizon A, which in general will be a function. Let me call these phi infinity, the scalars at infinity in Q. And typically, when you write down solutions that depend on parameters and boundary conditions, of course, all the property of the solution depend on the parameters and boundary conditions, particularly this area. But now, of course, we have the general claim that the entropy of the black hole should be the area in Planckian is divided by 4. So if the area of the horizon depends on these parameters, then we will start to see black holes whereby continuously varying scalars off of infinity, we can continuously vary the entropy. Okay, and since we were hoping and had examples where we could describe the entropy by counting states, the log of some definite number of states, which is presumably supposed to be an integer, this would seem very paradoxical. It's not what you expect if the entropy of a system can depend on a parameter. And that's not to say that it can never happen. Okay, there are more subtle problems in this one. But in this one, the entropy of the black hole does not depend on the parameter. And what one finds is that the combination of, well, you know, the reduction of the Einstein equations assuming supersymmetry. So we're going to grant that we're considering, again, GPS black hole so that we can trust our calculations, trust this result for entropy that we get. We reduce the equations of motion down to some first-order equations for a covariantly constant spinner, and they have the general form that the radial derivative now of the scalar field as a function of R takes the form of a gradient flux. Let me put an explicit index here. There's a metric on moduli space, the metric in the kinetic term for the scalar fields, and then d by d by j bar of some function minus sign. Okay, and then you can even compute the function. What the function is the function is the norm squared of the central charge of this object considered as a particle with charge Q and scalars phi. And then in the particular case of these Kähler moduli, you can write it down. It's integral of the charge vector. So trace VF, or equivalent of the charge considered as a sum of rank, two form, four form, six form, wedge e to the b plus ij. So here we know what the Taylor moduli are. They are in correspondence with classes in b2 or b11, and they are the periods of the Taylor form, which I'll write j plus the integral of the ns2 form. Okay, so we have this complexified, you know, this two form that was known as h11 with complex values, and we basically take the sum of all of its powers with an appropriate normalization, wedge it with the charge vector. There's one more correction, which is in terms of the curvature. It's just a bit of correction of one more, and it's, I forget what it's minus or plus 24, it's c2 of the tangent bundle in this case. And then this quantity squared over the volume of the quad EL, which is J here. Okay, so we take this function, which is explicitly depending on Q and on the moduli phi, which are B plus IJ, and we start off with this function at infinity, and then the solution, just the first order equations for a covariant constant spinner, which determine this DPS black hole solution, tell us that the scale is actually gradient flow down to the minimum of this function. I'd actually not quite like reading the right equation, something like this, where the decrease in R, I guess, let me write it this way to say that, I'll put the minus sign here. There's supposed to decrease in R, the fact that your time coordinate is actually 1 over R, it turns out, and this function is decreasing. Okay, so if you plotted for a given choice of Q by Q as a function of phi, you know, you'll find some minimum, and wherever you start out, the solution will bring you down, and it will stop at the horizon. Okay, so having worked out the solution, one finds that, well, yes, the area of the horizon does depend on Q and phi, but it depends on phi at the horizon. And then you want to show again that this area is, I think it's z squared phi at the horizon, exactly this function, up to some constant, which I'm not going to remember. It depends on your convention anyway. And so because the process of finding a solution has this attractor nature, the function f or z squared flows down to a minimum, one solves this paradox, when we resolve this paradox, it doesn't really matter what value of scalar fields you start off at infinity. You could have started off somewhere else and you always flow down to the same minimum. Okay, so now you could ask various questions about this or other subtleties that I need to come back to, or if there are different bases of attraction and so forth. But a small variation to the phi doesn't change the entropy. And so such a black hole has a definite entropy. Okay, as long as it is non-zero, well, it's clearly greater than zero by this formula, or equal to zero. If it's equal to zero, the resulting thing is not a black hole. In fact, there are two cases. Okay, so without going through the detailed analysis of this equation, the existence of a black hole solution presupposes that z squared at the minimum is greater than zero to get a black hole with non-zero area of the event horizon. Now, there's nothing about this function that says that it has to do. And there's also the possibility that z squared, z is zero at the minimum. And there's the possibility that things just become singular when you get to the node. And you can show that that's also associated with it. Zero and z, things will not get singular at generic points here. Okay, so having set up this problem, there are three cases. So start at phi infinity do a gradient flow. Okay, so given a queue, one vector value is a way to decide whether there exists a BPS black hole at a certain time. You take its charge, you take the modular fine unit, you start doing gradient flow of this function. And then either you get to a positive minimum, in which case a black hole exists, and you know when that is entropy. Or you get to a zero minimum at which the metric, the functional form and z and so forth are non-singular. Okay, and then black hole under this ansatz, I'm not to say that I mean by that shortly, does not exist. Okay, so if you find a flow that takes you to zero and there isn't any singularity, you find in fact that this solution of supergravity has a nonsensical singularity, just continues off into the imaginary space for the fields. And there is no sensible solution of this type. Okay, and finally, it's possible that Z flows to zero and there's something singular about it. Not about the solution itself, but about the metric or this function. And I might have a log singularity or something else. And in that case, you can find examples where either thing can happen. It could be that there really is an object at this time. It might be an elementary, D-brain that doesn't really form bound states, doesn't have a horizon, so it has zero entropy. In either case, you don't think the thing exists. But in any case, there are these two clear alternatives where you seem to get some sort of a clear prediction. Okay, so now what are we going to do? We're going to come back over here and say, well, I was first interested in this problem of the bundle. Then I decided that, the problem of the BPS particle is really very similar, to the extent that I don't, neglect any string correction. It's the same mathematical problem of finding these solutions of emission in Mills equation. And now there's some limit where I take the term classes of the bundle, its rank, and the term classes, and just scale them all up by a common factor n. Okay, so I'm going to consider the problem of finding a succession of bundles v sub n, where the term character of v sub n is n times the term character of my original bundle. So in particular, the rank is n times the rank, the c1 is n times the c1, and so forth. And now, clearly that has something to do with the original problem. This was a very general problem. I asked it for rank 3, 4, and 5, but I could have asked it for any rank. And now, by studying this problem, I actually get some sort of information about when these things should exist, because this large n limit through this connection takes it over into the regime of the black hole problem. For some fixed GS, there'll be some sufficiently large charge so that this argument should be valid. And by doing this really very much simpler calculation, this is just a polynomial in these variables and the charges, and then I look for the flow and the solution, I can now get some information about whether this private mathematical object exists or not. Okay, so that's the idea. So anyhow, what we try to do is, of course, make the things I just discussed a little more precise, and then to compare this with the known mathematical results about this problem. Okay, so one can introduce a bit of notation. It's maybe not necessary for the talk. It's the way we phrase the things in our paper. So I didn't tell you what mu stable is, and now I guess it's a good time to tell you that. Okay, well, the uh, Chris, what is a new stable holomorphic bundle? Well, I mean, many of you might be even asking, well, what is a holomorphic bundle? And I could give a whole talk about that. Basic examples of holomorphic bundles are the line bundles. Okay, so for a given, you know, rank is one, and any quantized C1, so something can have to be an H11 to get a holomorphic bundle, but for a Calabi-Yau threefold, there is no H20, so H11 is the same as H2. So quantized class in H11, there's some line bundle whose C1 is the assumed one. Okay, so let's just say given F. Okay, there exists a line bundle whose C1 is that F. And the basic example is you consider complex projective space. So CPN, and now you have coordinates, projective coordinates, Z1 up through Zn plus 1, and they're projective. So you identify points if they're related by a common rescaling of all the coordinates, and then you take out the point Z equals 0. Okay, so that's the definition of CPN, and functions on CPN are homogeneous polynomials, as it turns out, and the homogeneous functions have to be zero. So for example, zk over z1 would be a function. Well, a line bundle can also be defined by its sections. You know, just give all possible sections, assignments of a locally a function on, you know, the manifold, since it's a line bundle, it's just one member that satisfy appropriate, you know, transition function. That's the equivalent way. So, you know, the first way you read about it in the textbook is you give some transition functions. The next way you read about it is that you give some set of all the possible sections. It's a group because you can add the sections and so forth. When you talk about the sheaf of the sections. And then the homogeneous functions of degree k are the sections of the line bundle with C1 k times the generator, the quantum, the first non-zero positive element of this thing, and then people usually call this bundle strip of k. And we can talk about functions of negative degree for this purpose, the line bundles with negative first term class. Okay, so that's an example. And those guys are all new stable. Okay, now how do you make more complicated ones? Well, the next simplest thing you can do is you can consider the kernel or the co-kernel of some math. So you can do things like take a sum of a bunch of bundles of k, because they're just many copies of the same thing, and then postulate some math f into a sum of bundles and sum of L. So let's say a holomorphic map, so L should be bigger than or equal to K. And we'll take N of these guys. And now this is some big matrix, a M by N matrix of polynomials of order L minus K. And so whenever you give a vector of sections of these guys and multiply it to get a vector of sections of these guys. And you can show that if this guy has constant rank every place, and let's say the n is bigger than the n, then the kernel of this map is a vector bundle B, and mathematically one summarizes that what's called an exact sequence. Okay, so that's another general way of constructing non-trivial vector bundles, and you can compute the term classes of this guy in terms of the term classes of this guy. Okay. The simplest in terms of this term character formula, CH of V in this case is CH of this direct sum, which is just n times the CH of the one of them. And then these guys are actually just e to the LJAG vis-a-vis KJAG. And then you could do the same thing for manifolds with more classes in the H11. The projective space is fairly simple because it just has a V11H1, but you could write the same type of expressions in terms of some vector of integers and some bases for the H11 and do this on more complicated manifolds. So this is the first step up. This gives you lots of non-trivial vector bundles, and you can work out from these formulas when these guys exist and what charges you get. You'll find you pretty much get everything. Okay, so why did I say that there was any limit? It's because not all of these bundles correspond to solutions of Yang-Mills. Okay, so what would it mean? Well, what you're specifying implicitly when you say this, I never talked about any connection, and this is kind of subtle story that you don't actually have to specify the connection. Just given these functions, you can infer the transition functions. Just given the transition functions, you can infer a connection. A is like G inverse DG, and then when you write a connection like this, this is a holomorphic connection. This is something where all the transition functions are holomorphic, and you can easily get a holomorphic bundle, but it's not in itself a unitary connection. It's not true that A equals A adder in this construction. And on the other hand, you can start doing gauge transformations, and you can look for a gauge in which this guy satisfies A equals A dagger. And if you can find such a thing so that F11, so del bar A in this notation, is fixed form omega, then you solve the Hermitian Yang-Mills equation, which implies that you solve the full Yang-Mills equation. So the question of solving Yang-Mills for these bundles is much simpler than it is for the whole Yang-Mills. It really just is this, instead of having, n times the adjoint number of equations, it's just, one equation times the, the dimension of the group, the adjoint. But it's still a non-trivial equation that you have to solve. Okay, so now the power of this Donaldson-Uhlenbeck-Yau theorem that one called upon very early in this discussion, I mentioned it in passing, is that one proves, of course, non-constructively that solutions to this equation exist, just like Yau's theorem proved that this complex Kolodyi-Yau space had a Ricci parametric. But unlike Yau's theorem, there's another condition that you have to put, which is this mu stability condition. So if V is mu stable, so if and only if V is mu stable, there will exist this irreducible solution of the Hermitian Yang-Mills equation. Irreducible means that there's not some way of just writing as a direct sum of two solutions. And if we're trying to describe single BPS particles, of course, that's a condition for rent one, something that doesn't split up into two. And for the original problem, of course, you could debate which one you want. But for the problem at hand of describing particles and black holes, we want irreducible solutions. Okay, so what is a mu stable B? A mu stable B says that, it's easier to say what is not mu stable. Okay, not mu stable is there exists some sub-bundle, V prime. Okay, so there's some way of embedding it in this guy. There's some map with no kernel. And then there's a particular invariant called the slope, or mu, which is mu of V is 1 over the rank of V, integral of C1 of V, which with the Kähler form, n minus 1 times integrated over the manifold. So C1 plus J squared for this case of a threefold. Okay, and you find all the subbundles, and if there's ever one where mu of V prime is greater than mu of V, or even greater than or equal, if I insist on strict stability, then it's not stable. And conversely, if all the subbundles of this type have mu of V prime less than, then it is stable. Okay, so that's the non-trivial thing. So you can make still more of anything you want by planning with this sort of construction, but then you have to check this condition. And there's an easy thing to check, which is that you can see that there are various okays sitting in here, for example, you know, just the explicit ones that appear here, but there can be less trivial ones to check. And if there are any of those, then this actually doesn't correspond to a solution of the annuals or a GPS particle.
So the basic idea is to take new stable panels and scale the channels.
Right.
And you want to see if you can see that structure later.
That's right. So there's some set of charges for which these things will exist. Okay. So having set this up, I can say let CA, which is the notation we use, be a set of Turing characters or charges. Such that there exists some new stable bundle with that Turing character. Okay, so now what we're saying, the way of saying now this claim in this language is that the set of Q, okay, so now there's some set of Q over here, such that when I start with the Q and I start with I as that J and I flow down, okay, and I get to one of these points where the positive is it. Okay, I'm going to call that set the attractor set, starting at that jet. Okay, and so now what we're saying is that whenever we have a charge which is in this attractor set, then it's also in this set. And that's a conjecture, which is basically a case of the type of conjecture that Bregman made in this case. Okay, so over here, what basically the immediate upshot of what I've done here, although one has to think about it, is that we've actually drastically complicated the problem, because not only do we have to construct these things, and this is by no means all of the possible bundles, because you can now take the V's and you can start to take maps into other things and take the kernel of that. And you can make effectively longer sequences of bounds. These are physically bound states of the brain. Okay, this is basically physically something where you've taken n copies of this single P6 brain in this language carrying k's of flux, and you've combined it with n anti-brains carrying l units of flux, and you've let them annihilate as much as they can, which in this case of brains carrying different amounts of flux basically means condensed anti-brain tachyons between them. And in fact, you can show that the data in this map F is a matrix of expectation values for tachyon fields. And then you try to do that, and you get a combination of N minus N V6 brains carrying some more complicated vector bundle, exactly the point where the tachyon field is zero, so the brain didn't, so the brain anti-brain sometimes did annihilate. So there is this sort of nice physical picture going on with this mathematics, but having said that, it's still a big pain to take this construction, check the stability, and then generalize it. So the only general thing you can say at this point is that on a Clavier threefold, there's some sequence of V1, 2, 3, 4 of these things that you could always use to build it out of simple things like line models, but then you need four terms in the sequence. I mean, you consider lots of different kinds of line models and so forth. So it's not an easy way to get it. That's one reason the mathematicians don't have a very clear statement about the answer. But anyways, let's now grant what we just said, that, we're not answering the whole problem. Okay, we are basically at this point going to check if black hole, according to this statement, exists, if our charge is one of these attractive points, which demand is zero. Is that what the mathematicians would have believed was a set of Turing classes that correspond to stable bundles or not? That's right. They're really different string theories, but when I go off to the large volume limit, both problems basically involve solving the Hermitian annuals equation. So it's that mathematical relation that I'm relying on at this point. And the point that you have to think about in this is there might be certain singularities allowed on either side, and how you'd like to check that those are the same. And basically, for this problem, in the limit we're talking about, we're pretty sure that that doesn't matter. When these guys exist in this limit, there are all those things that you can make an actual bundle, not something with a singularity, but we're still thinking a little about that more. So I'm not really, it's sort of more of a mathematical statement than some sort of a duality, in the sense that we're not claiming that 2A is dual to hyperbolic or anything like that. We're just isolating this feature of the problem, which you could have given to a mathematician, and now using this other physical argument, which is just a 2A theorem, to say something about the answer. Okay, so how would we check this? Well, it'd be nice to know what points are in this set, and it'd be nice to know what the math students have to say about that set. And okay, so how do we map out this set? Well, it's a little bit of an argument, but you can actually show that, first of all, there are not basins of attraction over here. Okay, so this set actually doesn't depend on where you start. And it's actually not obvious. Okay, there's the basic argument that leads to that is that you compute the derivative of this function, and you can show that. Let's see, what's the best way to do that? So the question of whether there are basins of attraction is really the question of whether there can ever be critical points of this function, places where the gradient being shifted are not a minimum. If there are no critical points, then clearly there's only one phase of attraction. And then this, if you've looked at, you could probably make this notation. I'm going to translate it into kind of mirror notation. Okay, so there's a further relation which I've managed to avoid using in the whole talk, but which we use in the paper, which is that there's also a mirror version of this problem on the 2D string. And every place where we say Taylor modulus in 2A, you say complex structure modulus in 2B. And every place where you say e to the b plus ij in 2A, you say holomorphic freeform in 2B, and every place where you say charge, you say some class in H3. Okay, so the 2B mirror of this formula is holomorphic form wedge some class in H3, which is the Poincaré dual, say, of a three cycle that you wrap a brain on. It's not really necessary for anything I'm doing here. We're not using mirror symmetry in any essential way. But at this point, a lot of these arguments exist in the physics literature, but only they're written out explicitly in this other form. So if you go to this notation, what you'll find, well, before you go to this notation in supergravity, what you'll find is that this is the covariant derivative dz plus dk. Okay, so the same type of derivative that appears in writing n equals 1 supergravity. And so whenever you say this is 0, you're either saying z is 0 or you're saying dz is 0. Okay, well, if z is 0, it's manifestly a minimum because the function is non-negative. If dz is 0, you can show from this theory of Calabi-Yau's and special geometry that this is the definition from some geometric point of view of being an attractive one. The original class F is purely H30 plus H03, and you can show that this matrix of second derivative. I think, let's see, yeah, this is a direct formula, sorry. Yeah. What does the matrix of second derivatives look like? So there's terms d, d, z, and there's terms d, d bar, z. D bar, D, Z, D bar, D bar, Z. Okay, well, this term you can show is just the metric or the Taylor form times zero, similarly with this term. This term in general could have been non-zero, second derivative of the z, but what you find is that dbz can be written in terms of the Yukawa coupling times dz complex conjugate. Okay, so if dz is zero, these terms are guaranteed to be zero, and you get a matrix which is guaranteed to be positive, definite. So there's always, you know, so there's always, you can never have critical forms with these downward point back, with negative modes. So there can't be basically, well, the only subtlety in the argument is that this still allows for the case that such things could exist off of some boundary of the modulus space, and then that's the point where you have to know something about this to show that it doesn't have a. That was sort of a side point. My main point was to say that we're just going to write down, actually, this set. We're just going to write down the general solution, and it's not going to depend on J, and I'm giving you the reason why you know it doesn't depend on J. Okay, so what is the solution? What is the set of all charges which can satisfy this condition of being, minimizing this function z squared, which are attractive forms? Okay, the general solution is you take some choice of, let's say, b prime plus I j prime for all allowed b primes and j primes. Okay, what allowed in theorem means is that j prime has to be in the Taylor term, and I'll say what that means in a second. Okay, and then you multiply it by some complex number, which is what it is. Complex conjugate, just increase the symmetry of this formula. And you take the real part, and then the set of all of these things. Okay, so you choose a b prime and a j prime. You take the vector, which is 1 b prime plus I j prime, b prime plus I j prime squared over 2. Same thing, cubed over 2. And then you multiply it essentially by some phase, some arbitrary complex number, and take the real part. And then these are exactly the points you can get out of what looks like this very complicated problem of starting at some point in this space and flowing down and minimizing. Okay, so how do we know that? Okay, well, first of all, if you're at a minimum, then it has to be a critical point. And as I just argued, in fact, the only critical points are minimum. So you have to satisfy this condition that d0 defined this way is 0. And so you just have to write the general solution of this equation. Okay, so the, as I said, the sort of the geometric meaning of this equation is that the charge vector, or this form F, has to be a pure 3-0 plus 0-3 form, which means it has to be something you get as omega plus omega bar for some valid complex structure on the Columbia F, z prime, omega conjugate F. Okay, and then the omega is really ambiguous at the multiplying by a complex number. So knowing that this has given you the, the condition that the 2-1 part vanishes, so this is pure 3-0 plus 0-3 tells you that this is a general solution. And then if you use this dictionary, that goes over into just being the general solution. And you can check it by calculation directly. It's, you plug this thing in here. And again, essentially what we're saying is that there's this, there's a step in the argument which is not going to be convincing unless either you know the spectral geometry or you do the calculation. Okay? Because if you just plug this on as us into here and then take this derivative, you'll find it manifestly vanishes. Okay? And the nice way to see it is this decomposition of the space of all these forms into the mirror of 3, 0, 2, 1, 1, 2, and so forth. That's what we did to it. So, let me leave the argument as the conceptual explanation, and I'll say it. Well, now we've actually understood this one side of what we're trying to tap into, just write down the solution in the large volume limit for all of the attractive points. Okay, because all this, in principle, has corrections away from the large volume limit. That won't be, you know, what we're discussing in this talk, or something like that. We've got this large volume limit version of the problem. Okay, so now there are a few checks that you can already make at this level. So one of the kind of obvious things at an early stage of this problem is that for any bundle V, you can tensor it with a line bundle. Okay, so you basically just multiply the matrix transition functions by, you know, that function, you know, that transition function of the bundle to get another vector bundle. And this preserves mu stability. If V was mu stable, then this will be for any L. Conversely, if it's not, it's not. And the argument is that the Turing class is just additive. So all you're doing is you're adding the Turing class of L. I'm sorry, it's multiplicative, but it's additive under direct sum. It's the C1. Okay, the point is that what went into this formula, the C1 is additive. So you just shift all the C1 by the C1 of this bundle, and you preserve this condition because you're shifting the C1 of every bundle in the game the same way. Because if V prime that violates this before V, it'll be V prime tensor L that violates this, or V tensor L. Okay, so mu stable is invariant under this condition, okay, which is multiplicative. It multiplies the Turing character time I the Turing character of L, which is e to the c1 of L. Okay, so does this formula have this property? Well, what do you want to check? You want to check that multiplying this set by some e to the f preserves it. Okay, but this is just, these are forms, even forms in multiplication from use. So this is just this. And then that's just shifting e prime by f. So indeed, tensoring by a line bundle, multiplying by this EVDF preserves this set. Okay, so that was a very weak kind of consistency test, but that is valid. Okay, so now what's a more interesting consistency test? Okay, well, there's one well-established fact about this set of the mu stable bundles, okay, which is that you can show in general ground that C2 of any mu stable bundle wedged into J has to be positive. Okay, to be more precise, it has to be positive or zero, and for zero, it has to really be a line bundle. Okay, and this is a physical fact. This is saying that what is the C2? The C2 is, in some sense, the number of bound E2, the equivalent number of instantons that you've turned on in this bundle. And of course, preserving supersymmetry and keeping the state VBS only allows you to put instantons and not anti-instantons, and therefore the instanton number has to be positive. And if you were on the surface, that would be all there is to it. Okay, if you're on a prefold, you're checking this thing, which depends on the data file, so you might want a more precise argument, but that's physically the idea. And then this is the Bogomolov inequality. Okay, so now one can check that over here. And one can actually load it for the case where C1 equals zero. Okay, so if you combine it with this thing, you can get the general form, because you can first do this to get the C1 to be zero, and then you can apply this. You can, of course, write it as a more general form as a content of it. So now what we're basically saying over here is that in the special case of V prime equals zero, is there some condition on the sign of the J squared term? And it's clear there is. You get minus J squared. And now here's where this condition that J has to be in the Kähler comes in. So that's to say that the integral of J over every curve, the integral over J was J over every surface, and the integral of J cubed over the whole manifold all have to be positive. And then, you know, one can say more about this, but the essential point is this one, that the J squared that sits in here, and then the J cubed, which you get if you wedge it over here, all has to be positive by being in the Kettle cone, and then you get exactly this. So it turns out that this, the second term here, which is minus J squared is CH2, and you know, there's this overall minus line. And these I's are exactly what you want to make contact with the sign over here. So you immediately reproduce that. Okay, now there's this interesting thing, which we, I guess a little bit, well, Rene seems confident that this is meaningful, that strictly speaking, okay, this is the correct answer for the attractor, but now you should really put in this one, on, you know, this part of the formula when you make all your comparisons with the bundles. And this is some tiny shift of the second term class. And it doesn't make any difference in this limit, because the charge of the thing is scaling up from infinity. This is a property of the manifold that's getting fixed. So I'm not totally sure one's allowed to take this seriously. But if you do take it seriously, you actually get a slightly stronger thing here. You get C2 of N over 24. Rene says that you can check a lot of it, you know, this is true. So maybe this formula even supports this slightly stronger form of the bound that exists in the math literature. Okay, so now we did these basic checks. So now we can move on to the original question, which is, now what can we say about the third Turing class? Okay, so we got up to the 2 form, the 4 form, and the 6 form. And indeed, you can now examine this set, and the structure of this formula actually guarantees that the 6 form piece, the third Turing class, will satisfy the inequality, which has the form absolute value of C3, the 6 form piece of this. Is less than or equal to basically this j pi to the 3 hat to the q. Well, it's obvious, no matter what there. But then, because that's related to c2, I write less than or equal to, because you'll have to play with the c a little bit. And you know, the Dottier term here saturates the bound, but by making the c not real, you can get a bit of the lower order term in here. So that's what leads to this. And then this guy. It turns out to be something like root 2 over 3 C2 to the 3 halves, given that the C2 was the J prime square. Okay, and the C2 is positive. Okay, so this is the kind of bound that we get. We find that according to the attractor mechanism, there is a finite list of possible C3s. But the rank, it's all like this. Okay, one important comment to make about all of this is that clearly, this bound, everything I said here is homogeneous under scaling up the charge vector. So this one was homogeneous under rescaling up this charge vector. So anything we derive from this is going to be invariant in the rescaling the whole thing. So when I express it back in terms of these Turing classes, I'm always going to get ratios of it. So C3 over the rank, absolute value, is less than or equal to order one constant, which strictly speaking, is this. You might debate whether the formula is valid or whether this gets down to the stringy regime. So it's not obvious to take this constant too literally. It's, you know, certainly something in order one. And then times this 3 halves power of the second Turing class of the rank. Okay, so that's an interesting bound, and it does give us a physics version, you know, a different physics argument, you know, for this original plane, that you're only supposed to get a finite list of these C3. Okay, so we thought that was pretty. And now you can ask, does this match up with what the mathematicians know about this? Okay, well, what do the mathematicians know about this? Okay, there definitely is bound. Okay, I have been in contact with Langer and Bogomolov, not yet Mariana. Maybe I should try Mariana, because I haven't gotten a totally satisfying answer. Okay, so what is true is that it's not that hard by just playing around with things like this to get bundles that have that violate this bound. Okay, that have the C3 over the rank of order C2 over the rank squared. Okay, so you just violate this bound. Okay, so what does it mean? Okay, well, what it means is that we have to not over-interpret what we got here. So far, what do we get? We got that if is an attractor. You know, if that black hole solution exists, then the black hole exists, then this type of bundle exists. Now, you might have, and we were for a while tempted to say, well, suppose it's not an attractor, then the bundle does not exist. Okay, but clearly you are not allowed to say that. But over here, were you allowed to say that? Well, the answer is no. Okay, so now people have looked at this. I found a counterexample to this thing. The properties of these things have been quite a bit elucidated by Frederick Dennett. Okay, so what it turns out is that you again have to read this kind of legalistically. Black hole described by this Ansatz does not exist. That's what the argument literally proves. But maybe there's a black hole described by another Ansatz. Okay, and what the other Ansatz is a multi-center solution. So we just, by fiat set, we have this, single center black hole with spherical symmetry. And in principle, there could be some weird complicated black hole with more than one center and not spherically symmetric. And you might not think so, but Frederick Dennett has found those solutions and showed that they are also perfectly good candidates. And some subset of this quiz do provide black holes. So other black holes of this type can exist. Okay, so if you don't know the details of this analysis, all you're really allowed to infer is this. You get a sufficient condition for existing, which is this, but you don't necessarily get a necessary condition for existing. So you don't have to be bothered by this. All this is saying is that, well, not an attractor, but maybe it's not good. Okay, so now these guys, as I said, we found some of these biophysical structures. Now, our understanding of the mathematical results is that there is a formula that you can give in principle, okay, but it is complicated to work out, which has the form absolute value of C3 is magnitude above by something quadratic in C2 with some dependence on the rank. Okay, so it's consistent with the existence of these, and it's consistent with this bound. And it suggests that there's some sort of better bound to be found. But maybe if you included these multi-centered solutions, you would enlarge the set of charges to this. Okay. So now we looked at it there, and what you can sort of say is, well, what are the conditions for the existence of a multi-centered solution? Well, basically, there's a picture where you form them as bound states of two single-centered solutions. So there are some precise conditions involving the central charge and the relative electric magnetic charges of the thing. So this is sort of intersection. So you look at the two charges. Okay, they have to be mutually non-local. So this means electric charge of the one times magnetic charge of the other minus the magnetic charge of the first one minus the electric charge of the second. The usual kind of symplectic form, which appears in the Dirac quantization condition, and that has to be non-zero. Let's suppose it's positive. If not, we just reverse the ordering there. Then there has to be a relative condition on the bases of the two central charges, which are, if I remember correctly, is this. It might be the other way around. In any case, there's this sign condition on the phase, the ratio. If you imagine any part has to have a definite sign, and then that's the necessary, necessary condition for the existence of one of these split attractor solutions. And so far, from looking at Frederick's work, there's not a kind of obvious sufficient condition. Okay, this is the thing which you can easily check. Then you go and look for these solutions, and in practice, they exist. Okay, so I don't know whether this is sufficient or not, but it's really necessary. Okay, so now what you can try to take is the simple hypothesis that maybe this is a sufficient condition, and that whenever you can find a pair of guys here that satisfy this relation, then you can add up their charges and get one of these. Okay, and then this has a nice, pleasing correspondence with the simplification of what you would do over here if you try to make bound states or maps between bundles of this type. So this does have, so if you have the V, which is the bundle corresponding to the Q, you have the V prime, which is the bundle corresponding to the Q prime, you likely are to exist some map of this one F so that you can make this kind of construction And then the, you know, the kernel of this map is the D-level prime. Maybe it sits over here. And then this is the condition that there exists such a map, and this is the condition that it be consistent with mu stability in the limit, that the mu is being, you know, the mu of the V prime being less than the mu of the V. So up to things which are hard to check. So, you know, for example, you know, this gives you evidence that such a map exists, but what it is, if you know these things, it's like the index. It's like the index telling you the number of maps of this type of degree zero minus the number of maps of degree one is that map. You know, and so the easiest way it can work is that, you know, such a map might exist, but maybe it's a map of degree two or something else. You know, there are various loopholes. You don't know whether this guy is, you know, injective, you know, and so forth. So it's, again, it's some sort of a simplification of the condition over here. But if you're optimistic, you might say, well, you know, hey, we're treating this kind of simplified large charge on it. Maybe it's good enough. Okay, well, it all sounds good, but unfortunately, if you plug in two attractor points into this formula, you find you can get everything. Okay, so this is obviously not capturing the physical spectrum, unless it's the case that the physical spectrum includes everything. Okay, so what enough? But now, what do we compare with that over here? Okay, so if there was a strong mathematical bound of this type, okay, then this should definitely be a bound on the physical spectrum. And then this condition obviously is, you know, oversimplified, and whatever is the right thing has to prevent you from making things that are bigger than this. But as I say, I was unable to get a definite statement that the bound was this, in particular that it had this homogeneous dependence on the rank. Because if you look at the math argument, this whole idea that the bound should scale up, although it was true, it's actually true of the Bolden-Moloff bound and the other considerations in the problem. So it's not a crazy thing. But apparently they never saw any reason in their own considerations to think that it would always be a ratio of these quantities. And it's not at all obvious from the existing arguments whether it is. So there's this opposite possibility that there's just a bound of this one, and with some other dependence on the rank, and that when you then scale everything up, the bound just goes away. Okay, so that's as far as we got in comparing. So the strong, sufficient condition definitely is consistent with the constraints on the C3. There is this mathematical known bound on the C3. It has the same flavor as this, you know, some sort of conjecture bound that might come out of physics, but we're not sure whether the bound really has that form and whether it should bound come out of physics. But this is a pretty result. I'll stop there.
Is it right? No, it's